When we started Ask an Atheist about 4 years ago, there were always interviews that I really wanted to be able to do sometime during the tenure of the show. And today, I'm doing two of those. In the first part of the show, we'll be talking to Bill Cook, the Director for International Programs at the Center for Inquiry. He coordinates the work of CFI's international affiliates in far-flung places like Uganda, India, and Egypt, all from his home in New Zealand. I can honestly say, because we recorded this back in October of 2013 during the CFI summit, that this might be one of the more important interviews I've ever done in my tenure on Ask an Atheist. Following that, Mike and Dan will be joining me live in the studio with Sean McGuire, a Canadian atheist who writes at mysecretatheistblog.com. 2 years ago, he wrote a piece introducing Bwambale Robert, founder of the Kasese United Humanist Association and director of the Kasese Humanist Primary School in Uganda. It's going to be a very interesting show about stuff that we generally don't talk about, so stick with us. Bill Cook is the Director of International Programs for the Center for Inquiry. He has authored a number of works about skepticism and humanism, including A Dictionary of Atheism, Skepticism, and Humanism, Heathen in God Zone, 70 Years of Rationalism in New Zealand, and most recently, A Wealth of Insights, Humanist Thought Since the Enlightenment. He has a PhD in Religious Studies from Victoria University. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thank you.
I was, as a linguist, really intrigued by this dictionary of atheism. When you have words that, you know, have very diverse connotations, how do you define some of these really loaded words like atheism or humanism?
Yes, well, it's important to get this right. The dictionary was designed really as a popular almanac, so I wasn't really intending to do the final word definition. I was looking toward just looking at how they could be used in general discussion without too much confusion. So I can't remember exactly how I defined atheism in the dictionary, but I'm always just looking to a clear, concise, brief understanding of it that people can then go and use in their general conversation.
Do you find, you know, working as across international borders, that different communities have different conceptions of what atheism means or what humanism means?
Not so much with atheism. That's fairly clear around the world. Certainly humanism has quite different understandings. My last book that was mentioned in the intro, A Wealth of Insights, I have chapters on the way humanism has been understood in Africa, in India, in China, in the Muslim world, and among Christians, as well as the Western idea of humanism. And they're really quite different. So yes, humanism, I think some people see this as a weakness, but I think the very inclusivity, and if you like, the vagueness of humanism in the 21st century is its strength, because it does allow people in Africa, in China, in India, and all around the world to use the term with cultural links and understandings that are relevant to them and still able then to speak to somebody from another culture, find the interesting differences, look toward the areas of commonality. I find that really exciting about humanism. There's nothing wrong with a bit of vagueness in the 21st century, I think. It encourages the conversation.
So along the lines of that conversation, about a year ago, you did a trip to some of the African countries. You went to Kenya and Uganda and Egypt. What did you find in terms of the conception of humanism in Africa?
Well, yes, my job going to these countries is wearing my hat as the international director for the Center for Inquiry, where we have programs on the ground in all those three countries. And quite frankly, they're not doing the humanism side so much. They're more interested in the skepticism side, because the problem in particularly in Kenya and Uganda is problems of superstition and witchcraft. So it was rationalism that actually interested them the most, because they wanted to be able to counter superstitions and prejudices with respect to HIV. Some of the superstitions around how HIV is contracted in Kenya and Uganda are very scary indeed. Some of the sexual myths and superstitions are scary as well. So the problem there that they wanted was to be able to counter irrationality with rationality. So it was rationalism that interested them. They were quite happy and spoke about humanism, but it wasn't something that they were having to deal with in their normal day-to-day practice.
When we met on Thursday, this is something that we were talking about a little bit, which I find incredibly critical, is that we're getting, I hear a lot of stories coming out of these countries about, you know, some of the religious practices and witchcraft and stuff like that, and focusing on rationalism in those countries, and that seems to make a lot of sense to me, given a lot of the religious practices we're hearing about in those countries. And that's a critical, I think it's something really need to be talking about, and that specifically we're not, partially because we don't have much of an interface to it. We don't get a lot of news or know anybody who have a lot of detail on it.
Right. Well, there are some very, very worrying trends in Kenya and Uganda where religion is a frontier sort of society in many respects, and so there's a lot of quite enterprising pastorpreneurs, that phrase, you know, the mix between a pastor and an entrepreneur, are developing little religious groups of their own where they preach a rather primitive version of prosperity gospel to people who are not prosperous at all. And because the only people becoming prosperous in all of this are the pastorpreneurs, they compete very seriously with each other. There's one who has a Hummer in Kampala, and on his number plate is Kiwede, which in the local language is the text from John, "It is finished." And he drives, he's driven around the streets of Kampala, and he stands up through the gap in the roof and waves to the crowd like some sort of pop star or sporting icon, and it's a way of attracting attention to his particular church to get more people to come in, who he then inveighs with very frightening stories of sin and hell if they're not going to provide him with enough money. Also, I mean, he's now facing charges because he had weapons, he had a whole series of fake IDs on him, and a whole series of Ugandan uniforms from the army and police and various government sources. So he was a known fraudster. There are others who are sexual predators. This is very common. They're either quite consistent in their belief, they're taking the Old Testament seriously, they see themselves as a patriarch, and there's plenty of backing for them from this in the Old Testament. And so the sexual predator nature of a lot of these pastorpreneurs is making for it being even more dangerous for the young, and the young women in particular, in these cities.
Prosperity gospel can mean a lot of things depending on the context, but it really sounds like in this context, this version of prosperity gospel is give me money, you know, or give money to God, otherwise you will be sent to hell.
There's a clear element of threat in it. You need to give money to me now. If you don't, I can curse you. So the extra power of the superstitions there lends the pastorpreneurs a great deal more strength than they might get away with propagating the prosperity gospel in a Western context. So they're able to utter a threat, a curse, which is believed. So that's the problem. They can't afford to give the money, as is often the case with the recipients of prosperity gospels in the West, but they are under more threat and danger if they don't do so.
And can these pastorpreneurs basically take advantage of their flock, if you will, because it's mixing sort of different superstitious beliefs or different irrational, you know, sort of religious beliefs, mixing New Testament, Old Testament, local traditions, local cosmological, viewpoints about curses and witchcraft?
That's right. So one of them hands out envelopes with little stones in it and says that unless you keep this on your person for the next however many days that he says, the curse will return or there a new curse will be imposed upon you. So they're using a variety of old animistic beliefs and pre-Christian superstitions, which they've given a superficial Christian gloss onto quite often. So yes, there's a mix of all of these coming up, and also, of course, taking advantage of the incredible poverty and desperation of the poor people in the slums of Nairobi or Kampala.
I understand that they're taking a lot of animistic traditions and rolling them into their stuff. Are these pastors of a specific sort of strain of Christianity? Are they usually Catholic or evangelical, or is it just people decide to do this?
And most of them are evangelical. Okay. So they're listening to and quite dependent on some of the thoughts of American evangelicals. The influence here of the far right among the evangelical movement in the United States is clear. So they're strongly Protestant, strongly evangelical, with, as I say, this superficial underlay of animistic beliefs as well. There's relatively few Catholics doing this. The Catholics, to their credit, are spending some time criticizing these people, not least, of course, because they're losing punters, they're losing support to these, as is happening in the South America, where the Catholic Church is losing ground to this new brand of evangelical pastor. entrepreneur. So the Catholics and the older, more mainstream Christian Protestant denominations are opposing it, but their opposition is lukewarm because they can see that the pastorpreneurs are having an impact and the Christian message is getting out there. So it's rather a slap on the back of a hand with a wet bus ticket sort of disapproval.
Right.
So that's some of the really nasty stuff that's going on. But one of the things that I was curious about was the Humanist Orphans Program, because that seems to be sort of a way to remedy some of this nastiness that's going on. Can you talk a little bit about the families that are benefiting from the Humanist Orphans Program?
Well, this is one of the things that the Center for Inquiry is doing in Kenya. The orphans are usually because the parents have died, often from HIV, and of course the churches are very largely responsible for this because of their antediluvian attitudes toward contraception. So having created this problem, they then stand back from any serious attempt to deal with the issue of it, which is a large number of orphans. What we're finding is that finding a new home for the orphans is not particularly difficult. There's usually a relative or somebody who's willing to take them on, but because the relatives are desperately poor themselves and have children of their own to deal to, they then have serious economic problems of getting the kids into school. The way it works in Kenya is that you have to have a school uniform. Even if you're desperately poor, the school uniform is vital. It's a sort of insurance policy that the schools have to say to the parents, look, we're serious about education. You're going to have to put this money into a uniform. And the unsaid subtext to that is you're therefore going to need to make sure that your kid is at school. So one of the things that we do is we guarantee to the parents or the new caregivers that the kids will get their school uniform and the stationery and the other costs associated with being at school, so the parents aren't going to worry about their own kids losing out in that respect.
It's pretty incredible. So it's essentially, the uniform is a symbol of one's familial commitment to sending your child to school.
Yes, it is. That's the way it operates in Kenya. So being in school, if you go to school and even the short time without a uniform, it's almost like not being in school properly and you're not taken seriously and people think you're not going to be there for long. So the uniform is absolutely critical, and it's critical to the self-esteem of the kid because then they can say, I've got a uniform. That means I'm at school. And it's difficult to express in the West just what that means and how far these kids will come and how proud they were to show me when I was there, because they, of course, were all in their uniform. One little boy had torn his shirt, and he was inconsolable because his little uniform was torn, and it really mattered. So yes, the uniform has a very strong symbolic significance, and it's telling the kids, you matter because you are at school.
It's incredible. You know, so much research shows that one of the number one ways to raise the standard of living in a country, the economic development of a country, is getting more young people in school, especially getting young girls in school as well, making sure that they have that ability to complete schooling and have a future. So this really seems like a very homegrown thing, saying, you know, this is not CFI International coming in and saying, these are the programs we want to give to you. It seems to be very much receptive to what is of concern, what are the concerns of the people in those particular areas.
Absolutely. The CFI doesn't march into a country and say, right, this is what you're going to do. As you correctly observe, there's somebody on the ground. They know what the problems are. Our job is to listen to them. So George Ongere is our CFI man in Kenya. He's seen the need here. He's been able to get this program up and running, and that's what's happening. Whereas in Uganda, while that need is present there as well, there are people of different strengths. So a man came up with a medical background who saw the need and had the facilities to set up a little HIV clinic way in the back blocks of the Ugandan countryside, just outside a little village called Wabulenzi. And so there's a little HIV clinic there, dispelling the myths, again, dangerous superstitions and myths about how HIV is contracted and how it's not contracted. And they do blood tests, which they're able to send back and get. Of course, blood tests, as you know, provide all sorts of other important medical information. So it's a one-stop shop for people who can't afford to go into the city or won't be given the service anywhere else, for them to be assured, A, they don't have HIV, and to be alerted of any other medical conditions that they may be contracting. So very much, we want to go into the countries and help the local people who know what the story is, know what the main problems on the ground are, and know what their access to expertise is to do the jobs themselves.
This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. We're talking with Bill Cook, the Director for International Programs at the Center for Inquiry. We'll be back in a moment to continue the conversation.
Out of the briny depths of the internet comes a comic book podcast so powerful it cannot be contained by a single continent. Mike and Paul, save the universe!
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Paul Root.
If you're an unsatisfied comics fan, we want to help you find better comics.
And if you've never picked up a comic before in your life, we want to help you find what could be your new favorite thing.
On Mike and Paul Save the Universe, we love the bejesus out of comics, and so should you.
Find us online at mikeandpaul.com.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran.
And we host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. We invite a rotating panel of our friends over to talk about science fiction, comic books, movies, horror, animation, professional wrestling, video games, and George freaking Lucas.
It's a warts and all look at popular geek culture, where we tip sacred cows and use profanity while arguing about children's entertainment.
Think of it as the McLaughlin Group for nerds.
Find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an essential part of your business marketing, but that's not all. Want VoIP? We've got it, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to make your business communications succeed effortlessly. At Tacoma Telematics, we're committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
So you're on your Monday morning drive, and someone on Ask an Atheist says something that really, really gets your goat. You want to talk, you want to yell, you want to scream, and clicking the shiny red candy-like button just isn't good enough. Good! Call us! Leave us a message! Call Ask an Atheist at 206-420-0997 and vent your spleen now and for the future! That's 206-420-0997 and wait for the tone.
This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997, and now we continue our conversation with Bill Cook, Director for International Programs at the Center for Inquiry. It's difficult to talk about Uganda and HIV without discussing the political climate there right now.
Indeed.
You know, for those not in the know, that they have an anti-homosexuality law where I think it's even illegal to say anything nice about gay people at some point.
It is. There's it's against the law not to report homosexuals, not just homosexual activity, but the presence of somebody you suspect to be a homosexual. To fail to report that is an offense. So the attitude of paranoia, which again, both the Christian churches and the Muslim organizations in Uganda, same within Kenya, are in a strange alliance in this respect. I was at a conference in Uganda in 2004, which was a humanist conference, and a couple of very brave young homosexuals from the local area came and spoke, because it was one of the only areas, one of the only venues they could possibly have to address their concerns in a situation of safety. And that very afternoon, the conference was visited by the police, and we were given a fairly rude shakedown by the police about their presence there. And the press the next morning had these horrific headlines of homos meet in Kampala. So we had to try and disabuse the local media and the growing sense of anger among the readers that we could sense that there was some sort of Western homosexual agenda to destabilize the people with homosexuality, whereas, of course, that wasn't the case at all.
Is there anybody in Uganda that CFI is interfacing with to do something about these laws or change the prevailing opinions there?
Well, we have a CFI operating in Uganda. It's and it's doing what it can to deal with the superstitions with respect to homosexuality. Among the Muslim population in Uganda, it's often seen as a Western plot, like a lot of medicines are often seen as a Western plot, and certainly contraceptives are. Among the Christians there, the prejudices are slightly different. They don't quite as much see it as a Western plot, but they're more inclined to see it as a Western disease. So there's a xenophobic nature to the attitude toward homosexuality in a lot of the African countries, and it's got to be dealt with at different times. But I'd love to say that we were having some impact on changing the political regime there, but that's not the case, and it's going to take a while before that is listened to.
Whenever I talk about missionaries who go to other countries, you know, with people who are theists, they say, well, missionaries, you know, they go to other countries and they're there to proselytize, but they also do things for the local culture or you know, and they help out in significant ways. And without even saying that, you mentioned how that attitude has changed among missionaries.
That's true. I was born in Kenya. I was born in Kenya when it was a British colony, which is where this accent comes from. The missionaries that I remember and I was brought up with were of the old school, and they can be criticized for many things. They can be criticized for their patriarchal attitudes. They can be criticized for their patronizing, low-level racism. But they did build schools. They built hospitals. They left infrastructure there that was beneficial for people. The current lot are utterly negative and utterly parasitic. They are not contributing anything except a climate of fear. They are doing nothing but sucking money out of the economy to buy their execrable Hummers and these other ghastly things. So they're contributing nothing positive at all. All they're doing is exploiting very poor, very vulnerable people who already have little enough.
It's a really strong, strong reaction you have to that, or the way you characterize that. And I go back and forth also saying, well, you know, if you have the European colonizers that came in, often with their religious, you know, inclinations, that's, you know, very bad. But okay, you built infrastructure. But now you're saying literally the religious climate of the missionaries, of the people that are evangelizing, no infrastructure building, nothing, or on the whole, the takeaway is far, far greater than whatever they're contributing.
I don't think there's any question about that. And this is an opinion that a lot of other Christians would share. So regardless of one's position with respect to religion and supernatural claims and beliefs and so on, there's a lot of, as I say, the more orthodox mainstream Christian denominations who are as concerned. But as I said earlier on, they feel themselves to be hamstrung and unable to mount any effective criticism because, superficially at least, the evangelicals are on the same side as them. The only people who are really able to mount any coherent opposition are the humanists. I've got a very good example from India about that I could share if you like.
I absolutely would love you to share that, because we've been talking a lot about Africa, but there's clearly much larger places in the world, or, you know, there's a much bigger world than just African nations.
There is indeed. Well, let me tell you about, there's a place in Vijayawada, Andhra Pradesh, called the Atheist Center. It's not related to the CFI, but we are a kindred organization. I've been there 3 times. They minister to a group or a subgroup of untouchable girls called yogins. Now, in the Andhra Pradesh version of this caste system, these girls they're the ones who are the first pick as temple prostitutes. So, as you can imagine, their shelf life in that sort of job is very, very short. When they are then cast out of the temple, their usefulness there being no longer clear, they are fairly well unmarriageable, and their only way of earning any sort of living after that is by street prostitution at the very lowest level. The religious charities tend to avoid this issue. So the Christian charities in India avoid the issue because they don't want to offend the Hindus. The only people who help the yogins and actually bring them in is the Atheist Center. They have a hostel of 115 odd beds, and they accommodate them. They not only accommodate them, they provide them with some rudimentary vocational training. There's 2 types of vocational training they can do. Either as a nurse's aide, it's a bit more technical. It's not really, well, actually less technical. They follow around the nurses, and they're gophers. They go and get things and fetch things for the nurses. The other thing they can do, they're given a little sewing machine. So they've got two two possibilities of earning a living once they leave the hostel that does not involve prostitution. And it just means they have a slightly better chance of getting a husband, which in India, well, it matters everywhere, but it matters particularly in India for their safety, let alone their long-term security. So the Atheist Center is the only charity that picks up the yogins, that understands their desperate plight, and does something practical to help. The religious charities steer clear.
It's surprising when you say that the Christian charities would not want to interact with that, because they wouldn't want to ruffle the feathers of the Hindus or offend them. Is that because there are things in which they are aligned, or is it a matter of being associated with something like prostitution?
It's more just a political thing. They're anxious in a post-colonial sense not to be seen as colonizing. So there's a strong attitude, particularly in India, of associating Christianity with colonialism, not unreasonably. So the Christian missions and proselytizing agencies that are there tend to be rather anxious about not giving that impression. So that's why they just decide that's in the too hard basket and they leave it alone. They're also often sometimes beholden on the local state governments for licenses to continue to proselytize, and that license can easily be revoked if they get they annoy a reasonable number of people. So it's just safer for them not to involve themselves in it. But of course, the people who suffer from that are the yogins.
To that end, has the Atheist Center received any resistance from the people there?
On the contrary, the Atheist Center gets on very well. For instance, the Andhra Pradesh state government, quite often, when they have these periodic witch panics in the rural backlocks of Andhra Pradesh, somebody's goat has died, and there's somebody's looking for somebody to blame.
Right.
So somebody ends up getting killed. I've seen a photograph of a person who was buried alive. Thank you very much, who was buried alive because he was seen as being responsible for a spate of deaths among sheep. So when there's this new witch panic developing, the Andhra Pradesh government contacts the Atheist Center, who have trained people who can come in to help dispel the growing frenzy of hysteria and get a calmer attitude and hopefully prevent the witch panic from killing more people and ending up costing other people their lives. So no, the Atheist Center gets on very well with the Andhra Pradesh state government, gets on very well with other charity organizations. Only ones who disagree with them are the ones who are absolutely opposed to any sort of contraception. So the Catholic organizations have a problem. But the Atheist Center is quite pragmatic and deals very intelligently, I think, certainly with the state government and with other charitable organizations.
There's a lot going on in the world. Are there any other programs that the CFI is involved with that you'd like to shed some light on?
Well, we're doing some interesting work in Egypt, which is a particularly dangerous place to be talking about anything secular. But there's a very brave group of young people who, about a year ago, were walking through the streets of Cairo, where there's huge numbers of people who are illiterate. There's no point in giving them out written material. And they're walking through the streets and they chant Al-Maniya, which in Arabic is secularism. For a while, the responses they were getting were bemusement and hostility. But after Mohamed Morsi was elected and his Muslim Brotherhood government, and people saw what an unbelievable mess he was making of ruling Egypt and how unprepared he was to understand the diverse nature of Egyptian society, where 10% of the nation's population are Christian, for instance, and there's a significant population of secular-minded people, they were beginning to think, well, okay, I'm a Muslim, but maybe a secular government might not be a horrible place as I had feared it was originally. Maybe it might be the best guarantee of my Muslim faith, particularly if they happen to be working in the tourist industry, which is terribly depleted at the moment. Western tourists are not coming to Egypt, and so the country's economy is in a more parlous state than normal. So a lot of people were beginning to take a more positive and open attitude towards secularism, and that was, a lot of it was done just at the street level. Obviously, there are pamphlets and written material, but I was most impressed by these young people who were out in the dirt poor parts of Cairo, where illiteracy is rife, and just chanting the word so that they could see the reaction. And as I say, the general attitude attitude toward the word changed. But now, since the coup, I haven't heard from them for a couple of months, and I'm hoping they're not doing this now, because that would just be too dangerous.
Yeah. So this is some amazing stories that you're telling us that the CFI is involved with in the international program. Clearly, if somebody wants to participate and be a part of that, they should be a part of the CFI. But if this is what they would like to know most about or directly help out with, what is the best direction for them to go?
Well, they really need to just contact the Center for Inquiry and ask any further questions. They can email me. My email address, I think, is on the Center for Inquiry website. I'm happy to answer specific questions. What's needed, of course, is money.
Yeah.
We were, for instance, I asked when I was in Uganda, what is it you need most of all? And this was another little organization I haven't spoken about yet called Halea, which works in the slums of Kampala, where there's a more than 70% unemployment rate among teenagers, which makes them particularly vulnerable to organized crime, fundamentalist religion, and other forms of despair like drugs. There's a high rate of teenage pregnancy, which means that the girls' chance of getting back into education is even lower than normal. Halea asked me, when I asked them what I could do to help, the first thing they said, we need a motorbike, because they just need to be able to get around various parts of the slums of Kampala to deal with the various operations that they have running. For instance, they've just got a program in one part of Kampala where they're helping 10 teenage pregnant girls to attend school each day so that they don't slip out of the system altogether. I mean, their chances are pretty bleak anyway, but at least they're being helped to stay in school, and they've got some chance of finishing their education and getting a position where they can get a job. So we've, Center for Inquiry has provided Halea with a motorbike. It sounds small, it sounds unimportant, but that was the first thing they said. So there are lots and lots of things. Another thing that's particularly in Kenya they have said that they wanted was basic information. They're not interested in information about is there a god or is there not a god. They're not really interested in that. What they want is information about how to combat primitive superstitions, how to give proper information about contraception, why contraception is safe, why it's not a horrific Western plot, these sorts of things. This is actually needed in India too. There's a marvelous organization, the Indian Rationalist Organization, which goes around the villages. This is science teachers, and in their holidays they go around the villages and they show the villagers how the godmen, because wandering godmen come around the villages and they do tawdry little tricks with magic. It's just basically magic. And the overawed villagers then give them what they want: money, food, sexual preferences, whatever it is. So these science teachers go out and just show the villagers how the tricks are done, in the hope that the next time the godman comes into the village, they will not be showered with coins, but they will be showered with rocks.
You live in Auckland, New Zealand.
I do.
Yeah, it's a bit far, you know, there's a bit of a time difference, but anytime you'd like to, this has been a fantastic conversation. This is exactly the kind of thing I wanted to put on the air when we started, you know, doing Ask an Atheist as a radio show. So anytime you'd like to update us on what's going on the international front, I would really love to hear from you.
Well, I'll be happy to do that. Thank you very much for the time and for the exposure to what we're doing. I really think it matters. I have a sense that what we're doing is important. We're really helping people's lives. It's not complicated. We don't have to get postmodern about it. It's just good people doing good things.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Ask an Atheist, 206-420-0997. We're going to go into a break, and when we come back, I will be joined live in the studio with Dan and Mike as we talk with Sean McGuire about the Kasese Humanist Primary School in Uganda.
Secular humanism is a non-theistic view of the universe built on a foundation of reason, science, and democracy. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking, and we hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of freethinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. For information on how you can be a part of the humanist activities in the Puget Sound area, become a member of the Humanists of Washington today. Visit humanistsofwashington.org.
Billy!
Not again!
Billy, I'm a certified ghost expert!
Wow, that's so credible!
Billy, your great-great-grandmother says she loves you, and to give me your lunch money!
Aw, anything for family! Here you go!
Wait, Billy. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I know.
If you enjoy the programming we create on Ask an Atheist, please make a contribution with us. Your sponsorship keeps our show in the air and improves the quality of our broadcasts. Don't make us beg. Please go to askanatheist.tv and contribute today.
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
Psst. Hey, I know that we all slip up sometimes, but not knowing your STD status at all, not a smart move. Did you know that STDs can even be transmitted through oral sex alone? Yeah, worried yet? With stdhometestkit.com, everything you need is shipped to you, where you'll have results in the comfort of your own home in less than 10 minutes. Be certain of your status with stdhometestkit.com.
Ask an Atheist may have gone on the road, but we're not making big bucks.
We still need to keep the lights on, and 95% of our costs are for airtime alone.
That's why we need your contributions.
If you've got something to advertise, consider Ask an Atheist in your ad budget.
Our listener Peggy said it best. Step up and contribute to keep secular voices on the air. For $5, you could have a latte or a moment of science.
Take on Peggy's challenge and contribute today.
For details, go to askanatheist.tv or contribute directly via PayPal to paypal@askanatheist.tv.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist 206-420-0997. And we are live now in the studio. And with me is Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
And Dan, how you doing?
Great.
Awesome.
High five.
Let me undeafen myself here. That interview, like I said in the pre-show, is, I think, some of the more important stuff that we've done on the show, to be honest with you. It's the kind of thing that I was really hoping we would be able to do with Ask an Atheist at some point.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the things that we hear over and over again from Christians who say, well, oh, everything would go to hell in a handbasket if they went away and if their ideas went away and that they have a monopoly on helping people in the third world.
Yeah.
This is a great example of how that's so not true.
Yeah.
And that if you want to help people in the third world, organizations like the CFI exist so that you can do all the good that you want with none of the proselytization that you don't.
Yeah. CFI had some trouble a few months ago, or actually like a year ago now. They mishandled a lot of stuff. And I'm not trying to undercut that, but there is a reason why organizations like the CFI exist. And if one of the things that I came away with from October when we were at this, and this is part of the reason why I'm playing this now after I've played all these other interviews, is I don't understand why CFI didn't make what Bill Cook and the International Group is doing like a centerpiece of their conference, because this is so critically important. And this is exactly the kind of thing that absolutely needs to be funded. I mean, this is as far as a social movement goes, as far as I'm concerned, this is what we're for. You
yeah.
know, there's really no other way to put it. You know, not only abroad, but here in the States, too. I mean, this is what social movements are supposed to do.
Yeah. Bad ideas hurt people, and they get their power through people's ignorance. They get
yeah.
their power through people's superstition, and they make a lot of money and hurt a lot of people in their wake and then just leave town.
Yeah.
Or they just continue to hurt generation after generation. And this is the antidote to that, which is not only teaching people to protect themselves, but also protecting them from the consequences of being different in a society, often religious, that doesn't value differences,
yeah.
that has this very specific way of doing things and says, do this, or, you know, that horrible life that person's living as a prostitute or on the streets, that's what you get for not having Jesus.
Right.
I mean, this takes that away and say, no, you don't have to listen to that angry man who dresses like a wizard.
So we have a couple very quick announcements that I have to go through. First announcement, we have no contributors to Peggy's challenge, cue the fail trumpet. What the heck, guys?
Bum, 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 bum.
Yeah.
How was that?
Yeah, we need your help to keep the show going. So go to askanatheist.tv, click on the yellow button, and it'll take you right to our PayPal page. Every dollar you give goes straight to show production. I'd also like to let people know that the Tri-City Freethinkers is welcoming Ask an Atheist guest, Robert Parham of the Clergy Project, at the Kennewick Library on Saturday, May 10th at 1 p.m. He'll relate his personal experience with becoming a non-believer after 13 years in the ministry and talk about the latest developments in this innovative community of former and current clergy who doubt and disbelieve. And then a little bit closer to home, you really should go to that. Robert Parham's an incredible speaker. But a little bit closer to home, Ask an Atheist is presenting Delivered from Dogma on Wednesday, May 21st at 7:30 at the Highline in Capitol Hill, featuring Ask an Atheist co-creator and comic Jeremy Whitman. Your presence at this fundraiser helps ensure Ask an Atheist keeps going. Jeremy Whitman's hilarious. It should be a lot of fun. And it's a very important story. He's got an amazing story about how he started out as a believer in a Christian school where his dad's the principal to where he is today, which is, I would say, a bit far away from that. So continuing in the theme of the first part of the show, now joining us is Sean McGuire. Before we go on, are you with us, Sean?
Yeah, here I am.
Awesome. Great. Sean McGuire is a Canadian atheist who writes at MySecretAtheistBlog.com. 2 years ago, he wrote a piece introducing Wambali Robert, founder of Kasese United Humanist Association and director of the Kasese Humanist Primary School in Uganda. Over the past 2 years, Sean has spearheaded advocacy and fundraising for basics such as improved nutrition, building materials, and agricultural resources at the school. He's here to tell us about his involvement and how the school has changed in just 2 short years. So, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, no problem. So how did you first learn about Wambali Robert's group and the school?
There's a bit of a story behind this. Basically, it was May 2012, and I had just heard about Seth Andrews' Doing Good Without God campaign. Basically, I put out a post because I was interested to know, like, what motivated Christian missionaries or charity workers in these places versus atheist charities and secular charities. And I did actually get in contact with some Christian missionaries via email, but I also managed to get into contact with Wambali Robert because I did a search for humanist schools in Africa, and he came right up. And so basically what I did is I realized that it would probably be better just to sort of highlight the good work being done by atheists across Africa and other places, because that doesn't get a lot of airtime. So I basically wrote a blog piece about that back in 2012. And after that blog piece, it just sort of took off from there.
Fantastic. So this school is incredibly interesting to me. I mean, we were listening to the earlier interview and what was going on there. This stuff is absolutely critical. So give us sort of a sense of history. 2 years ago, when you started hearing about the school, what was it like?
2 years ago, the school had only been around for a couple of years, believe it or not. So it was living on a small plot of land of a disused railway station. They were renting that out. They still are, actually, but they're building new classes elsewhere. And they had even barns. They had converted barns to classrooms with big holes in the walls. But they were already doing some pretty good work even back then.
Fantastic. So this was the point where you entered the story. So you did a Google search and you found this group and Wambali Robert. How did you contact them, and what was that like when you stepped forward and said, I'd like to assist?
Actually, I was kind of surprised when I contacted Wambali. He very nicely responded right away, and he basically let me know more or less the sorts of things that they needed, school supplies, shoes, and uniforms. But to be honest, it wasn't until I got into contact with an American volunteer working at the school, Daniel Loving, and he let me know that the diets of the students were woefully lacking for protein. They were just basically eating all starch. So he suggested providing eggs to the students. I went back to Wambali and said, how can we buy eggs for the students? And he let me know that, you know, what really would help would be if actually building a chicken coop on the land.
This, a chicken coop is not what you expect when you start thinking about funding education and letting schools happen. But here's a cut and dried reason why it's absolutely necessary. There are nutritional needs that need to be met, and being able to generate eggs on site is a lot superior than having dried ones shipped in or having to ship in fresh eggs every week.
Yeah, exactly. So I started up the fundraiser. It was about $2,300 that was required. And I just said, okay. And I set up a PayPal account. And they looked at me kind of funny at Western Union when I would walk in making a money order for two money orders for $1,200 to go to Uganda. But
jeez. Did they start going?
Got done.
Tell you a story about spamming and stuff like that? Did they figure it was something like that?
Yeah, I got some of that. It's actually extraordinarily difficult to send money to the school in Uganda. They're not allowed to set up a PayPal account in Uganda, so they have a very hard time collecting money from out of the country.
So you have the chicken coop set up. I assume then that the students are also learning the care of chickens. Are they learning other agricultural things as well and better ways to provide for themselves and their families?
Yes, so the chicken coop did get built. Part of that was actually due to some coverage by other larger blogs, which helped out. Basically the kids learn how to care for the chickens. They learn how to, you know, take the eggs, and they even cook the eggs. If you go to the site, you can actually see a video of them eating the eggs.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, yeah.
Never thought I'd be interested in a video of watching people eat eggs, but but here we are. So you said
it's the simple things.
Absolutely. So you say they're actually beginning construction on some new buildings. What's going on there?
Well, I think it was probably January, I got in touch with Wambale and I said, you know, I want to set up a fundraiser to help maintain this chicken coop. And, you know, how much do we need to pay you to maintain it? And he said, oh, no, that's good and all, but I'm actually going to buy some land. And he said that would cost $7,000. So we had another fundraiser for that. Once the land was bought, we were able to also raise enough to put power to the land. Now we're in the process of hopefully building classrooms, and they've set up the nursery is already actually functioning. They have built that building, and they also have a kitchen, some latrines, and they're actually currently building a media lab and a library as well. So this is all money being raised essentially at acauses.com, and it's all being raised by the humanist and atheist community.
So, Sean, that sounds like you're not done yet. It sounds like there's a lot more you like to do. Ideally, where would you like to see this school? What kind of stuff would you like to continue to build? Is there anything new that you desperately need? Anything that seems pie in the sky now, but it's like, we can do this? What are your goals for the school?
So basically the ultimate goal here is to make the school more self-reliant. That means having a garden area that they're building as well around the school to grow their own food. And the actual structures themselves are only about 60% complete. So there are two organizations that are currently helping the school, Atheist Alliance International and also Humanist Canada. And if you go to the donation pages on either of those websites, you can help out. Mainly, I would ultimately like to see more organizations stepping up to the plate and being money streams to the school, because as I said before, it what seemed to be the biggest challenge for me is to try to get an actual stream of money from us to them in a reliable way.
That's sort of a going theme in both interviews, is that these things take resources. And when you talk resources, you know, on Earth, generally that means money. And it can be extraordinarily difficult to get money from one place to another when you're being transnational. So what sort of systems do you have in place right now? And what sort of systems would you like to see that change to as time goes on?
So right now, I have my own fundraiser. It's at tinyurl.com/humanistschool.
Fantastic.
That is being done by causes.com, but unfortunately they're changing their payment system in the end of May, so I have to actually shut that fundraiser down. I'm going to have to make a new one. My goal is to raise $10,000 there. We're almost there. But once that's done, I'm going to be pushing Atheist Alliance International. They've helped me out ever since the bid to buy the new land. They were helpful in getting the money to where it needs to go. They have the connections. Also, Humanist Canada recently has begun funding the school. They're helping to build the main hall. And that is useful because you can get yourself a tax receipt, I believe, from Humanist Canada, and also, you know, if you're in the States, you can do that through Atheist Alliance International.
So, Sean, the thing that really surprised me when I first heard about this was that it was in Uganda, and Uganda, of course, has been on the radar of a lot of freethinkers because of the influence of U.S. evangelicals, anti-gay laws. How does a humanist school even happen in a place like Uganda, and let alone thrive?
Yeah, that's interesting because this isn't actually the only humanist school in Uganda. You also have the Humanist Trust, which is in Uganda as well, and they run several humanist schools. It is interesting. In the neighborhood around the school, I've spoken to Mbwambale, and he said that although some local Christians in particular aren't very happy with it, people appreciate the services that the schools are providing. This school is providing, for instance, computer literacy education for the parents. The nursery is obviously taking care of their kids. So providing them with meals in certain circumstances. There are foreign sponsors helping to feed their kids, and many of the kids are also orphans. So I think that could be possibly the reason, but even on my fundraiser page, you can see some blowback from some of the locals who are not at all impressed with the school being there.
But does the opposition end with just general grumpiness, or is it something where you see people mobilizing against it? Because the more I look at the way Uganda seems to pass laws, it seems like church and state, yeah, it doesn't have an official religion in the country, but it seems like more of a formality. And I wonder, is it perhaps, like you mentioned, that you're doing all these good things for people who really need it? Is that kind of blunting the potential opposition that you would have? Or is there organized opposition?
I don't believe that there's any organized opposition, but what you will find in the school itself is that their particular stance, for instance, on sexuality, because they are a primary school, they will teach the students, basic humanism. They'll teach the students how to think critically. But because of the legal situation in that country, they kind of steer clear of taking any kind of position at all when it comes to sexuality. And because it's a primary school, they don't really have to.
This is something that I really hadn't considered. I've been mostly interested in just seeing education, education being sent, and honestly, just humanists and atheists actually, you know, functioning as a social movement. You say they've got sort of a basic humanism curriculum. Do you know what that looks like? I'm curious about that.
Generally speaking, it's my understanding that it's mostly science-based. The humanism. From what I gather, they do teach humanist ideals, the idea of human rights, The idea that you know, no religion is to be taken literally on face value, and to question these things.
Right.
In contrast with the Pathfinders went to the school recently in the fall. And Connor Robinson, who's in the Pathfinders, he pointed out he took a sample exam from the government issued curriculum, and it's absolutely crazy. They have questions like, "Who created the universe?" And you're supposed to write God. Oh. So, in comparison to what's out there in the rest of Uganda, it's very, I guess, it's not a religious school, it's not a parochial school, and they do have humanist literature and also CFI literature in their library as well.
Fantastic.
Available for the students.
So we have a bit of a special show today. We are going to be wrapping up the on-air portion of our show in the next couple minutes, but the show continues for another half hour on AskAnAtheist.tv on our stream. Just go to our website and press the play button, and you can hear our show continue on. Now, a little bit on a personal note, you have a secret atheist blog, and now you're on a radio show, so I'm assuming the secret atheist blog has become somewhat not secret in recent times.
Yes. This was a joke also that Hemant Mehta made the first time he published one of my pieces with my real name on it, that it's not such a secret atheist blog. It started out as a secret, believe me, but I found that for instance, being called Godless Poutine, which is my writer's name on the blog beginning out, I got a little tired of being referred to as a cheese curd and a fried potato snack. So
oh, jeez.
I imagine it's kind of a compliment.
It's most delicious.
Well, that's unfortunately all the time we have for the on-air version. Thank you very much, Sean. I would very much like to talk to you again and get some updates on this. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. Leave us a voicemail at 206-420-0997. Email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. And, stick on the website. We have another segment coming up, and we'll see you in a few minutes.
Ask an Atheist may have gone on the road, but we're not making big bucks.
We still need to keep the lights on, and 95% of our costs are for airtime alone.
That's why we need your contributions.
If you've got something to advertise, consider Ask an Atheist in your ad budget.
Our listener Peggy said it best. Step up and contribute to keep secular voices on the air. For $5, you could have a latte or a moment of science.
Take on Peggy's challenge and contribute today.
For details, go to AskAnAtheist.tv or contribute directly via PayPal to PayPal@AskAnAtheist.tv.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran.
And we host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. We invite a rotating panel of our friends over to talk about science fiction, comic books, movies, horror, animation, professional wrestling, video games, and George freaking Lucas.
It's a warts and all look at popular geek culture, where we tip sacred cows and use profanity while arguing about children's entertainment.
Think of it as the McLaughlin Group for nerds.
Find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
If you are a humanist, atheist, or freethinker from Everett, Washington to the Canadian border, Humanists of North Puget Sound welcomes you. Your freethought neighbors to the north have been promoting secular ideas for over 20 years. They're humanists with a rational worldview informed by science, inspired by art, and motivated by compassion. Join up for monthly conversation, camaraderie, and activism. Humanists of North Puget Sound. Visit humanistsnps.org.
To
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an essential part of your business marketing. But that's not all. Want VoIP? We've got it, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to make your business communications succeed effortlessly. At Tacoma Telematics, we're committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
So you're on your Monday morning drive, and someone on Ask an Atheist says something that really, really gets your goat. You want to talk, you want to yell, you want to scream, and clicking the shiny red candy-like button just isn't good enough. Good! Call us! Leave us a message! Call Ask an Atheist at 206-420-0997 and vent your spleen now and for the future! That's 206-420-0997 and wait for the tone.
If you enjoy the programming we create on Ask an Atheist, please make a contribution with us. Your sponsorship keeps our show in the air and improves the quality of our broadcasts. Don't make us beg. Please go to askanatheist.tv and contribute today.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, the after hours version. I don't know how to describe it yet, but we're in the third segment, the secret third segment.
You've unlocked the hidden track.
Yeah, the hidden track, as they say.
This is
the newest version of the theme. Brought to us by Phil Whitfield. It's the 8-bit version we've been asking for a long time. And I love it.
We can have it for the Ask an Atheist 8-bit NES emulator game.
I would very much like to have a Nintendo game.
What
personally.
Kind of game genre would it be? I'm thinking something like Maniac Mansion. Sort of a marriage between a point-and-click adventure game and some kind of puzzle solver.
Are you sure it's not going to be something like Metal Gear, where we're trying to get around all of the horrible, Christian shows that have tried to kick us off over the years?
Maybe.
Boo-doo-boo-boo. Yeah, where it's like
you sneak around the conspiracy show.
Yeah, yeah.
We could do it in the style of that. What was the manga video game about lawyers where it's got the objection meme? You know, the one that I'm talking about.
That's something Action Attorney.
I have a phone number if you'd like to call in and talk. It's not our usual phone number because this is still all on my dev crap. It's 253-248-6604. Again, 253-248-6604. But we've got plenty to talk about. I mean, there's been a whole lot of news going on lately. I know there's some stuff that Mike wants to get in. We've got some great And the Horse He Rode In on stuff coming. But there's just one story that we really got to talk about because it was going to be the centerpiece of the show last week because it was so it was so weird and so strange and so obvious that we had to cover it. A man crushed by a crucifix dedicated to the Pope. A 21-year-old Italian man reportedly was crushed to death by a giant crucifix in the Italian mountain village of Sivo. The 98-foot-tall wood and concrete structure was dedicated to the late Pope John Paul II. Marco Guisimni had been posing with friends when it collapsed, killing him and injuring another. The freak accident came just days before the dual canonization of John Paul and Pope John the 23rd.
So this is the thing that I wonder about. When you build anything,
you mean other than the irony?
Well, yeah, it's like something out of a Monty Python sketch.
Right.
But when you build anything that large, don't you have to prove that it's stable?
Do you have to do that?
Yeah, if it's an art installation, I don't know if you'd have to do that.
I imagine that, you know, it's got a Frank Gehry look to it. I saw it before it fell down.
I mean, even with art, we have the Hammering Man in downtown Seattle. Yeah. If that could at any moment fall down and murder tourists, I'm pretty sure somebody's liable to a lawsuit because this could have possibly killed someone other than him.
I'm pretty sure the lawsuit's coming, if we're being honest. I can't imagine that day won't arrive, but irony. I mean, because last week everybody was talking about the Pope and the canonization, so now I guess it's Pope John Paul the 23rd the Great. Is that how that works?
I guess, yeah.
Okay. I don't play that video game. But
I would say just, you know, it seems to me if you're building a structure of this size, you should probably
wind up.
Found it on something other than faith and maybe use concrete.
And the pitch!
At least dig it into the ground. I mean, even a fence. And the fence isn't nearly that heavy.
You
pitch it into the ground a little bit, a little concrete something to keep it sturdy.
Maybe the neighbor dog, like, you know, got a little exuberant and was digging a hole under it or something. That dog is undermining our faith.
Stiff wind knocks your thing.
There's really not much to say. This is one of those stories where you read it and you sit back and you just go, huh. That sucks, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, I don't know what you could say about it other than being kind of a jerk and going, look what happened.
But
you know.
Is that not what we're doing now?
No, it's really not. I think there's sort of if I may use the word meta in that horrible way, I mean, we're sort of like, wow, what do you do? And I mean, that's kind of what I'm saying.
Well,
it sucks that he's dead. I'm never happy when people die.
No.
You know, I that's...
I can't...
Well,
I don't lie. I am
Fred
sometimes
Phelps.
Happy.
Yeah, I guess.
I guess I'd say satisfied is a better word.
Yeah.
I'm not going to
Kim Jong Il.
Yeah, I'm not going to throw a party, but I think the world is better off.
Right, right.
What is it? The comic book Hitman had a question. Oh, how do you feel when you kill somebody? He's like, how do you feel when you flush the toilet? Honestly, it feels a bit like that. It's like, wow, humanity just got
well, not
per
this guy.
Not this,
this
yeah,
guy
this
was
is...
just some dude taking a picture in front of a crucifix and it fell on him. He doesn't deserve this.
No.
Nobody deserves
No, but
that.
He doesn't deserve it, but I'm not going to like mourn him.
Okay. Fair enough. You're kind of a jerk. So, speaking of jerks, Glenn Beck claims one-third of the Constitution came from Deuteronomy. After oddly claiming that Abraham Lincoln was quoting Jesus when he said that a house divided cannot stand, radio host and conspiracy theorist Glenn Beck upped the ante, citing Christian pseudo-historian David Barton, so you know it's going to be good.
Sure.
Beck claimed that 33% of every federal line in our Constitution and Declaration of Independence comes from the Book of Deuteronomy. The Glenn Beck program is currently syndicated on over 400 stations.
Yes. Humanity.
We were thinking about doing an episode about Glenn Beck back in the day.
Yeah.
And but then he like really cratered. And I don't even remember what the genesis of his cratering was, but...
Well, I think it's this. This is what it is. I mean, he was a Fox News personality for a while. And
yeah.
There's two different genres of being a broadcaster for Fox News. I mean, you can be just sort of a right-wing blowhard. I mean, that's a thing. That's what Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity does.
Yeah.
That's not really what Glenn Beck does, and it certainly isn't what he does anymore. And the difference between these two things is why he's no longer on Fox News and why he's not the figure that he used to be. He isn't just angry about things because of economic reasons. He doesn't like Obama because of blah, 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 the usual stuff. He's a conspiracy theorist.
Right.
Where he's claiming that, like, protests in Wisconsin and Egypt are connected through a caliphate that's going to take over the world and team up with the communists.
And the lizard men.
Yeah, and he has these elaborate charts on chalkboard. I mean, this is the very...
I love the chalkboard stuff.
It's the very stereotype of what a conspiracy theorist does, running across a chalkboard to tell you how it's all connected.
Yeah, yeah.
And now he's adding this weird pseudo-Christian nation dominionist garbage to it. So it's this weird marriage of David Barton and Alex Jones. So he's not really in the Rush Limbaugh genre anymore. And Fox News, who sells right-wing blowhard as a product, is really uncomfortable when you start talking about the Antichrist in that way. Yeah, they'll be friendly to that.
Right.
But again, they're running a business and they don't want to look outright crazy. They want to look vaguely crazy.
Right. Just vaguely crazy. Just a little bit crazy.
Just a little crazy.
And that's why we wouldn't do a show on, say, Sean Hannity, but Glenn Beck is really the sort of thing Ask an Atheist can talk about, because we're talking about all sorts of bad ideas.
It goes back to our political thing. When we talk about politics, it's got to be politics that has something specifically to do with atheism, skepticism, and the separation of church and state. Glenn Beck, unlike most other conservative blowhard talk show hosts, and blowhard talk show hosts, that's what I do. He hits all of those.
Yeah.
All three, all the time. That's his shtick. So he was sort of the perfect talk show host for us to talk about. And he's showing up on Right Wing Watch with such regularity now
that
I'm beginning to wonder if we should take that show off the show.
I think it's worth looking at. I mean, we might be doing that show right now.
Well, we're doing part of it. You know,
well, I look at Glenn Beck, and it's funny because you can tell that when he was on Fox News, there was actually a segment where he was on television with Bill O'Reilly. I guess this was a Marvel team-up. And this was during the time where Glenn Beck was the golden boy of the network. He was the guy. And Bill O'Reilly, of course, is a good company man. They were on together. They were talking about this massive communist/Islamist conspiracy.
Yeah.
That was
which
behind,
we're a part of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's a part of it. It's just a big group of them.
Yeah.
I've got a conspiracy theory about Glenn Beck. I think Glenn Beck is actually the real Florida man.
Oh.
Follow the Redditor Tumblr about Florida. I don't know if he's
here.
From Florida. It doesn't matter.
He's from Bremerton.
Oh, God.
I'm going to get out my chalkboard here, and if you draw a line through the Kamchatka Peninsula, the most communist place on earth, and through Seattle, it winds up right there in Florida.
I see. Okay.
It's not a straight line, but it curves a couple places.
Slightly due to gravitational distortions of large liberal populations.
It's for the same reason why your pool table has a tilt. Even though you guys spent a long time with a level, there's a deposit of hyperdense matter below
exactly.
your house,
right.
causing gravitational disturbances. Speaking of,
you can only see it if you put a blessed compass on it.
But getting back to this thing with the Marvel team up, when he was going off on this conspiracy on Fox, and you can see Bill O'Reilly shifting in his chair, really, because they're like, they don't want to go to the conspiracies, they don't want to go into like, oh well, this prophecy says that, and now that he's not on Fox News anymore, and there isn't that sort of corporate oversight keeping it from going into that weird direction, he has his own radio station, which he already had, but now he has this online news network called The Blaze.
The Blaze.
And it's crazy. It's
The Blaze.
You want to see what Glenn Beck is like with Fox News corporate guys basically telling him, don't go there. That's really uncomfortable. Those guys are gone now. The leash is off, and he has gone to crazy town.
I just thought of a really deprecating commercial based off of The Princess Bride for The Blaze. He's only mostly dead. Put the thing up to him, and they press on his lungs, and he goes, The Blaze.
The Blaze.
He's mostly dead, so he's watching The Blaze. Hey! So speaking of gravitational deposits and gobbledygook and drinking pencil shavings, Dan, you've got a moment of science for us today, and it's about a subject I'll go with it. it's one of those.
Sure. As some of our listeners are probably aware, today is May the 4th, which is... For pun reasons, Star Wars Day. So today's moment of science is about science as it's presented in the Star Wars universe. In the spirit of the day, I'm not going to mention all of the stuff that doesn't really work in our universe, but rather I'd like to focus on the stuff that just might. First, the twin sons of Tatooine. In Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, we see that Luke Skywalker's home planet of Tatooine has two suns. So this means that it's a planet in a binary star system, one that has two stars that orbit around a common center of mass. It certainly looks cool at sunset and with the dramatic music, but could such a system really support a planet? And as it turns out, yes, absolutely. A recently discovered exoplanet called Kepler-16b exists in just such a binary star system. As a biologist, one of my many arguments with the Star Wars universe is that some of the planets seem to have only one type of biosphere. There's the forest moon of Endor and the ice world of Hoth and the desert planet of Tatooine. Of course, contrasting with our planet, where we have ice caps and we have deserts and we have jungles and forests and oceans and all kinds of different ecosystems. But it's easy to imagine that a planet in a binary star system would receive more solar radiation, meaning more heat, more light, and less liquid water on the surface. So it lends some plausibility to the idea that Tatooine might be just one big desert. The next one I want to address is lightsabers. The lightsaber, of course, as fans know, is the traditional weapon of the Jedi Knights. It seems to be able to cut through just about anything except another lightsaber. But is it really possible to make one? Well, last year, a team of physicists at Harvard and MIT discovered a way to make photons, the fundamental particles of light, clump together in molecule-like waves that behave in much the same way that the beam of a lightsaber does. The scientists used lasers to blast these photons through a cloud of rubidium atoms, which caused the photons to bind in what's known as a Rydberg blockade. So given enough power, this new form of matter could certainly cut through just about anything and would still bounce off another beam of the same material. Containing it and making it flashlight-sized are the only remaining challenges. The third one, and this is kind of my favorite because it actually delves into a lot more, I guess, sort of wishy-washy mathematical quantum physics stuff, is hyperspace. And hyperspace is the faster-than-light travel that inhabitants of the Star Wars universe rely upon to cover the vast distances between star systems. Because faster-than-light travel does not appear possible in the known universe, a hyperspace jump involves jumping into an alternate universe through which faster-than-light travel is possible. But could a universe like that really exist? Or for that matter, could any parallel universe really exist? Well, the Star Wars films begin with the line, "A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away." So we can assume that what's happening in the stories is supposedly happening in our own universe, just at some other time and at some other place. And that means that the normal laws of physics, as we understand them, are going to apply to the Star Wars universe. But recent findings in gravitational waves that may have originated with the Big Bang have led to reconstructive models of early expansion in this universe that make the simultaneous creation of multiple universes possible, if not probable. Furthermore, that mathematical modeling suggests that our universe may exist in a Type 4 multiverse, one in which different universes may have different physical constants. And that means that in these other universes, there might not be a constraint on light speed. The gravitational constant, Planck's constant, could all be different than they are here. So the laws of physics could be very different. So hyperspace jumps, as they appear in the Star Wars universe, just might actually be possible in this universe.
Nice. I hope so. You know, if I were to say I have one article of faith, you know, in the traditional religious sense, it would be that faster than light travel will eventually be possible. Because, not because I don't know why, I don't really have a good reason for it. Actually, I do have a good reason for it. Because, boy, the universe would be boring otherwise.
It would take thousands and thousands of years just to get across this galaxy, let alone get to another one.
I also don't like to say that technologically something is impossible, because you've said that about so many things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we are able to do things now.
Like do a radio show from your bedroom.
Exactly. Yeah. That works. We can...
You
we
sleep
can,
here?
Yeah, we Sometimes. Can speak in a way that can be heard by people on the other side of the planet and be recorded for people to hear long after we've died.
Yeah.
We can travel to the other side of the planet in a giant metal tube that flies at hundreds of miles an hour.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, this is amazing, the stuff we could do. This would be wizardry.
It's a people caught gun. I just, he described it like that, and I'm thinking a caught gun flying through the... flying through the air with people and going, ah!
It feels that way sometimes.
And I feel a little vindicated on your first point. Way back in the days when I was a proto geek, and I was hanging out with some friends who worked over at Argonne National Labs, and a friend of mine was writing a science fiction short story that involved a planet orbiting around a binary pair. Not actually orbiting around the whole pair, orbiting around the center point of gravity for both stars. And so she was like, is that possible? And the physicist was like, duh, 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 duh. And I'm like right behind him going, I'm kind of helping, but I'm kind of also giving him beer, so I'm kind of also not helping.
Right.
But we figured out that, you could actually get a fairly, not like Earth stable, but like a metastable orbit that could exist for long enough in a Goldilocks zone in order to generate life. And it was like, hey, that's cool.
Yeah, it was a big surprise when Kepler-16b was discovered, because prior to its discovery, the thinking was that any planet that was in a binary star system, if one managed to form or managed to drift into the system, it would get pulled into a disk shape by the mutual gravity.
And he was like doing some like back of the napkin stuff, and he said, well, you know, if this was going to be a planet, it had to be like a captured planet or something like that, because the accretion disk. Da, 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 da. And I'm just like, okay, that's cool. I have no idea what's going on, but I'm cool. And then that Kepler thing came out, and I'm like, vindicated,
right?
You know, and it's like, yes.
So I'm kind of coming off of bad memory here, and this is out of a movie too. I know more about movies than I do about actual science.
Fair enough.
So I know a lot of bad science.
Yeah.
But this was a Arthur C. Clarke one. 2010.
Ah, yes.
Didn't the planet Jupiter become a sun at the end of that movie? And if that happened, what would actually happen to our solar system?
As I understand it, Jupiter just doesn't have the mass to become a sun.
Well, that's why they ignited it. I mean, in a way, it's kind of like it's like an infrared sun. It gives off like an incredible amount of infrared radiation. It gives off like a lot of RF. It is an emitting body. Like, every planet emits something, but Jupiter emits a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, given its size, and it what they did in 2010, and Arthur C. Clarke being Arthur C. Clarke, he actually did a lot of the science, or got scientists involved to say what would happen if somebody lit up Jupiter. And it wasn't that they turned it into a sun. They basically just well, that's what the monoliths did. They made the thing more dense so that fusion would begin. But it had a very short, because it didn't have as much fuel as the sun.
Sure,
it had a much shorter life of something like 1,000 or 1,500 years. But it was long, you know, in the context of the story, it did its job.
But what does it do after it burns out? I'm not a scientist.
Right. Is it going to go red giant? Is it going to...
I really doubt it.
Who knows what happens?
Well, what would it expand to its original dimensions? That's a really good question. Let's find out. I'm going to go get a lighter. Let's go to Jupiter. We'll get this figured out.
If you're going to start a fusion reaction, you're going to have basically solar wind that's going to keep some of the particles further away from the center than they were when they were, say, Jupiter. And when that fusion runs out of fuel, then it's going to collapse back in on itself. Okay. But in the meantime, what's it going to mean if Jupiter gets bigger than it actually is now?
In the spirit of this Sunday, because when this show ends, I get about an hour and a half reprieve, and then we're doing a Radio versus the Martians. And in the spirit of a show about geekdom, we have an email from Brendan from Utah. I'm going to give this one to Dan, because I think he can answer it. But don't kill me with your answer.
Okay.
Oh, my interest in Star Wars is well registered. Why are there no android Jedi? I hope the official answer isn't about souls or midichlorians, because that would be such a cop-out.
Is
this an expanded universe thing?
Yes, it's okay. In Tales of Star Wars number one. There's a story about a droid called R5-D4, who is a Force-sensitive Jedi droid, and refers to himself as Skippy. but this is, you know, this is extended universe. This is canon.
Okay.
And R5-D4 actually makes
what
an appearance.
Right, well, we'll go.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm not George Lucas. I don't get to make up the rules.
George Lucas doesn't make up the rules anymore.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. He's got investors and stuff. But R5-D4 actually makes an appearance in Episode 4, A New Hope, when the Jawas are getting ready to sell the droids to Uncle Owen. And this R5-D4 senses Luke's presence, and he senses that Luke can use the Force. And he gets a glimpse of the future of Darth Vader and Leia and all this stuff that's going on, and sees what's going to happen if Luke doesn't take R2. Because R2 has the stolen plans, and so if Luke doesn't take R2, then R2 gets collected by stormtroopers, Princess Leia gets killed, the rebellion falls, and the galaxy becomes a horrible place. So R5-D4, being a Force user and an altruist, willfully destroys a component in his own head. And that's the exploding droid where Uncle Owen says, "Hey, what are you trying to pull here?" And then they end up buying R2 instead. So that's the little backstory on that guy.
Okay.
I don't think we're going to disagree on this one, Sam.
No.
I can see the look on your face.
As a transhumanist, I don't have any problem with a Force-sensitive robot in as much as I have a problem with the Force, period.
I have a problem with the storytelling thing there. Yeah. I hate the idea, and I'm a huge fan of nerd stuff. I love big science fiction fantasy franchises. I like the idea that you don't have to stop with the movies, and you can do comics and novels and board games and video games and whatever. But why does everyone have to frickin' know each other? Why do we have to have everything? Can't he just be a broken robot? That's what he is.
Well, this is an author wanting to be a part of that story. And so they find a character for which there is no story, and then they proceed to write one. I can kind of understand the psychology behind it.
And this is space opera, too. I mean, we're not trying to be, you know, Isaac Asimov here. We're not trying to make things plausible. I mean, Star Wars, I would say, is more about the story arc than it is about the technology or the realism of the
world. It's like the series of source books I wanted to write for role-playing games, like especially role-playing games that take place in the near future or modern day but have like magic and stuff like that. Like in Shadowrun, it would be the five people who have no special powers left in the universe, and how because when you have stories like these, when you have universes like these, you want everything to reflect sort of where that universe differs from the universe that you're in.
Yeah.
It was like when I used to GM, everybody, you know, GMs like people to start out with like very little power. I kind of bucked that trend a little bit. It's like, you know, I want people to start out with cool things to do, because honestly, real life is interesting. If you're going to make me play a normal human being, I'm going to go be a normal human being in my lab or something, you know, and I think that's kind of where that comes from.
I guess when getting back to Brendan's question, I hope this question doesn't involve souls and midichlorians, and don't read fantasy. You know, a lot of the questions are going to be supernatural.
As it happens, I don't.
And Star Wars, and like we're talking about, it's not an Asimov thing. And I really think the Star Wars is really the progeny of a kind of science fiction that we see in the pulps.
Yeah.
Stuff like Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers. The sort of things where guys have swords and women in bikinis hang onto their legs while some dude in a cape with a collar is going in the background.
Yeah.
And people with wings are coming to the rescue. I mean, that's the sort of stuff that it is. It's very, I guess you could say, John Carter of Mars.
Yeah.
Sort of science
fiction. Not the Disney
fantasy.
One.
I've heard that's actually a good movie.
I need to see it.
It's not
bad. I need to see it. I really like the old pulpy stuff.
But that's really what it is that don't expect good science out of those, because good science isn't the point.
Right.
My main objection, of course, is not a robot with magic powers. It's the fact that everything has to be connected on a narrative level.
Yeah, that's annoying. But that's what MMOs are for.
And it's sort of the tradition of opera, let alone space opera, rock opera.
So I think we're going
to
be going. I think we're going to be going a little long. This is Ask an Atheist Extra Large, I suppose. We're going a little long. We're trying an experiment this week for doing some material off the air, just to fit some more show in. If you'd like to give us a call, 253-248-6604. That is our temporary number as I work on a phone system. I've got a couple news. The reason we're going long is there's a couple news stories we have to do. One of them is local. An anti-gay judge gets a standing ovation at a Pierce County prayer breakfast. For those of you not in the know, Tacoma here is in Pierce County, and that's where I live. Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore received a standing ovation at Friday's Pierce County prayer breakfast, where he warned a crowd of 1,400 that a spiritual battle was raging across the country over acknowledging God. Moore is known for having been thrown off the bench by a judicial ethics panel for defying a court order to remove a Ten Commandments monument from the Alabama Judiciary Building. He has served as Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice since being elected to the position in 2012. Though Tacoma City Council members refused to attend due to Moore's strident stance against marriage equality, Pierce County Executive Pat McCarthy did attend to greet the crowd.
Yeah.
So,
that's the
this
thing.
Is Pat McCarthy is one of the is when back in the, over the summer when Pierce County was trying to give money to Christian organizations. She was really nice to me. We had, you know, kind of good rapport as we were talking, and then basically voted against everything. Now that it's kind of all said and done, that was the Pierce County Council. I have this. A lot of issues I have with those guys.
Yeah,
and I imagine the people I have issues were at this prayer breakfast. I'd have no problem believing that.
Oh, no. See, the thing with this guy, and the thing that horrified me about learning about this, is that it says Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore, not former Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore.
Yeah.
I had known about the time that he got thrown off the bench because it was that giant stone monument that he had up. And he spent several years as a professional fake martyr doing the Christian speaking tours and talking about how horrible secularists are ruining this country and how he had stood up for God. And it angers me that these people in this state put him back in that job.
Yeah.
I mean, he was removed for ethics reasons. He's like, you know what? If the higher courts say this, I refuse to recognize their authority, to the point that he got thrown out, which means he's going to do stuff like that again, which means this is the way his mind works.
Yeah, what he's basically saying is, as a judge, screw representative democracy. I'm going to do what I want. Alabama is now my tiny empire. And he's getting standing ovations in my home county.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in all fairness, it was only 1,400 people. I mean, it's not like they sold out the Tacoma Dome here.
No, but this group of people clearly included politicians who think they represent me, when in fact they know we
know. I know we like to downplay numbers like 1,400, but that's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people.
There, if you get 1,400 people together for anything, if we had a fundraising event for Ask an Atheist and got 1,400 people, well, that would be a huge success.
I would die of fright. What do we do? We got 1,400 people here.
We'd be like, how do we have enough chairs?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of people. I know it's easy to downplay that because we're thinking of how many people come to a Sarah Palin rally, but that's a lot of people still.
Yeah.
It's more than should be.
to this guy. I mean, it's not just to any kind of prayer meeting. I mean, because, you know, these National Day of Prayer things happen all over the place. The president goes to one.
Right.
But the one that he goes to has the president at it. So it's a lot easier to get more people to that thing. And it's a bipartisan affair, where this one seems to be about this weird kind of dominionist garbage. The fact that they invited this guy at all tells me what kind of people are in charge of it.
Yeah.
I also like sort of the semantics here, where they're saying that the battle is raging across the country over acknowledging God. Well, I mean, they don't really want an acknowledgement here. I mean, because, you know, let's say that, you know, suspend disbelief for a few minutes and say that we're not atheists, but we, you know, acknowledge the existence of God. And they're like, hey, do you guys believe in God? Yeah, sure.
Well,
that's not what they want. They want worship.
Here's the part
praise,
that Becky really wanted us to read. And this is a quote from apparently what he's been saying is, without God, there would be no freedom to believe what you want.
That's just a word salad.
That's yeah.
No, it's not a word salad.
It means nothing.
No, it does mean something. And what it means resolves false. Word salad would mean, without God, there is no rutabaga to push through space. I mean, this guy is saying that without a God, you couldn't believe in whatever you want. Where he's just trying to cut people like us out of the debate. This is not word salad. This is fighting words. This is him coming to us and saying, you guys have nothing to stand on. You are not citizens. And we are talking about a guy who treats his state like his own tiny little despotism with which he can do what he wants.
Yeah, and this is
not word salad.
Recently credited to him, though I couldn't find the original quote,
yeah,
was him apparently saying something to the degree that the First Amendment only appeals to Christians. I have no problem believing that he said something like that, because I've seen him say things almost exactly like that.
Right. Well, heck, we have former presidents who basically say stuff like that.
To people like him, the legal system is the legal arm of Christianity.
Yeah.
And they believe that they have an act to rule that way. And these are the same people who scream bloody murder and spit nails if they have to share that thing with somebody else. If the courthouse puts up that, oh my God, the Satanist monument, which is glorious, by the way.
It looks awesome.
Is glorious the right word here?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay.
If they put that up next to that, these are the people that would scream, and they would come with all sorts of excuses about, oh, I don't have a religion. I have a relationship with, and they come up with all these distinctions that mean nothing, and all it really means is, yeah, well, mine's true.
Yeah. So we have two more news stories, and they are kind of related, because we're dusting off an old segment here called And the Horse You Rode It On, which is about blasphemy around the world. A British tourist was jailed in Sri Lanka for a Buddhist tattoo. Naomi Coleman, a 30-year-old British tourist, is behind bars in Sri Lanka for having a tattoo that, according to the local government, hurts others' religious feelings. Coleman's tattoo of the Buddha reflects her adherence to that religion and is not intended to be offensive. That seems to matter little to the local Buddhists, who have a history of violence over religious differences. Last year, as reported by the BBC, a group of Buddhist monks led an assault by hundreds against a Muslim-owned garment warehouse.
Yeah.
So, point one, this whole Buddhists kind of have it right as far as religion goes. Can we put that one to bed?
Yeah.
I think so.
Guess what? Okay. They're humans that believe things that are weird, and they get really angry when other humans believe things that are different.
Yeah.
This is nothing new, and it's something that Buddhism is not immune to.
This isn't something that is just in the wheelhouse of religion, but religion almost never fails to do this. When they get in power, when religion has power over the secular world, suddenly it's against the law to believe anything else. There is no exception to this now. There's none that I can think of. You know, you can say, well, some of the New Age movements have never done that. Find me the New Age country. And when you find it, you will find a place where it is illegal to not be a New Ager.
Find me the Wiccan governor that's forcing stuff down children's throats and through the schools.
Well, that will
come. It doesn't have. I mean, that's the thing is, that's what I mean, is that, you know why there isn't that happening? Because there isn't a Wiccan governor.
Exactly.
And who got up there through a really, really aggressive Wiccan lobby.
I know I have a lot of New Age friends, and even some New Age listeners to the show appreciate what we do who are not going to appreciate this, but this is how it works. Every time a religion gets power, without exception in history, there's an abridgment of personal liberty.
They go to
period.
The
full stop. find me this exception.
They go
please.
To the truncheon so fast.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's just amazing. It blows my mind. And actually, there was even another story, and this has been ratcheting up because the hardline Buddhists in Sri Lanka have been getting increasingly more violent.
Yeah.
Their demonstrations, or they'll throw rocks at people. And there was another person who got jailed. It was a couple of Muslim merchants a couple of years ago that got thrown in jail for selling keychains with the Buddha on it.
Jeez.
I mean, that's where this is. We're talking about straight out. Buddhism is no better than any other religion.
Yeah.
Yes, they made it. I think that it's different in the sense that I think it's harder to be a hardline Buddhist than it is to be a hardline Muslim.
Unless
hardline
you're talking
Christian.
About sexuality, there it stacks up really horribly.
Oh, it's right on line. I mean, it's just as sexist and horrible and anti-sex. But I'm saying it's harder to become a violent zealot Buddhist. But not impossible. Clearly.
I won't even go and say it's harder. I'm not certain.
Yeah.
I'm really not, because we have the history of Tibet before China came in.
Yeah.
We have Sri Lanka. We've got Myanmar in some places.
Well, the reason I'd say harder is that it's so easy to find. It's a lot harder to not find the pieces of the Bible and the Quran don't tell you to kill people. It's a lot harder here, but again, all it takes is power plus supernatural belief and someone appealing to an authority and saying, no, the divine wants this.
Yeah.
There is no reprieve. You're bad. Okay, mob, let's get together and throw rocks at that dude.
So going from a story that is unexpected to some, we're going to a story that is completely expected to most. An Iranian poet has been executed for blasphemy. According to human rights groups, poet Hashem Shabani has been executed by Iran's government for being an enemy of God. Shabani, a vocal critic of human rights abuses, was found guilty by the Islamic Revolutionary Tribunal of waging a war against God and spreading corruption on earth. Shabani and a man named Hadi Rashedi were hanged in an unidentified prison on January 27th.
This depresses me.
A lot.
I mean, clearly. I mean, the thing is that this is not Pakistan, that we're so used to. Pakistan is a place that has an uneducated populace, a fundamentalist government.
Right.
This is a fundamentalist government and an educated, modernist populist. I mean, if there is some
becoming increasingly less so as the fundamentalist government continues to hold power.
It depresses me because it's like if there's ever a population in the Middle East that could be an ally to the West, it's Iran. I mean, the people, not the government, the people.
Right.
I take special issue with this because I think, you know, as I've said many times in the past, you know, if your faith is so fragile, if it's so weak that someone writing a poem or singing a song or drawing a picture can hurt your religious feelings to the point where you want to execute someone, you have made a fundamental mistake as a human being.
Yeah.
Let alone as a citizen. I mean, you have done something very, very wrong, regardless of what you believe. Mm-hmm. If you think that, you know, it's worth a human life to stifle another person's art, to stifle another person's expression.
Yeah.
And ultimately to stifle someone's life.
And ultimately to stifle someone's life. I don't even know what to go with this. I mean, there are a lot of ideas on what separate, you know, human beings from other animals. And as a biologist, I'm not really partial to any of them. But I don't know of any other animals that would do this sort of thing, that would say your expression is so bad that we have to kill you.
Right. Well, I guess that's the downside of it. And I have no problem saying that there's a difference between people and other animals, because there are. And I think the root of that is you have an expression that is so bad that we're going to kill you. What makes us different from animals is the value of that expression in that way. That does make us distinct. There are not many distinctions. It's mostly a matter of wiring density in some places, but it does. And I didn't really want to end on a down note with these, but I think it's important for us to talk about this because of what we talked about in the beginning of the episode. There are things we can do. There are concrete things that the atheism community can do, that the humanism community can do. We showed you some of them today. We've been talking about them through the entire tenure of the show. And as we approach our 200th episode, hint, hint, this is important to us, that we are this episode and episodes like this one come to the heart of why I think continuing to do Ask an Atheist is so important, and why we keep growing the show, and why we're building this outlandish studio to keep the thing going. It's this is important. And people, you know, we got an email from Jane who asked us about charities. You know, she wrote, she's a fan of giving donations in lieu of gifts. She's from Los Angeles, and she writes, is there any resource for atheists to help determine charities, which may or may not be religious at their core, that don't condition aid on evangelism? Well, you might think having humanism in your curriculum might be evangelism. I don't, and that, but that's a conversation for another day. But here are atheist institutions that are having an incredibly positive effect on the world. These are people who need our help, our assistance. Not only do we need to talk about them, but frankly, and I'm not the kind of guy who talks about this, even though I do Peggy's Challenge every week, they need money. We need to give them money. And that's what it comes down to. And that is the end of the extended version of Ask an Atheist. I don't know how to do credits when we've already done credits, so thank you very much, Mike.
Hey.
And I love doing this, and I'm going to keep doing it for a while. I hope this works. We'll see you guys. Oh, thank you, Dan, for Moment of Science. looked at you, and then I failed to thank you because I'm dumb.
Don't worry about it.
See you guys next week.